Summer is here, and we have a great read for you, perfect for hammocks or when you're out on a dock or a porch swing or wishing you were. Set in Minnesota, it begins as the story of Lars and Cynthia Thorvald. He knows his balding exterior hides the beating heart of a great chef. She's a small-town girl hoping her skills as a budding wine expert will get her out of town. But pretty soon, they are both gone, and we're left with their daughter, Eva, who goes from bullied schoolgirl to 20-something renowned chef, and along the way takes us on a culinary tour of Minnesota, Wisconsin, the Dakotas, from an upscale culinary website to a church basement where women are tasting their dessert bars ahead of a county fair as a violent storm hits.
"How exciting," Celeste said, smiling. "Well, even if we're stuck here," Sandra said, slicing herself a Mississippi mud pie bar, "at least we won't starve to death." "Oh my," Karina said, taking a bite. "Celeste, these are incredible." Sandra looked at her own tray of bars and shook her head. "Well, I don't have a shot this year. Celeste, if we don't finish them all here, I'm going to steal them and take them home." "Thank you," Celeste said, looking down at her feet. "It's just an old family recipe, nothing special." "Why a copper mixing bowl?" Pat asked Celeste. "Oh, for the egg whites," Celeste said. "It stabilizes them. Don't ask me how." Barb looked at Pat. "You didn't know that?" "I actually don't separate my eggs for bars. When I'm making a souffle or sponge cake, I add a little cream of tartar to my egg whites, and that does the trick for me." The other women nodded. "Oh, don't get me wrong, though. Who wouldn't love to have a copper mixing bowl?" Pat was quick to add. "But we just got to work with what God gives us."
And that is fierce competition, Minnesota style. The book also includes a recipe for those terrific Mississippi mud pie bars and Eva's upscale meals. The book is called Kitchens of the Great Midwest. It's out in paperback. We spoke with author J. Ryan Straddle last August and started by asking, where did this come from?
I grew up in Minnesota. I grew up in a small town called Hastings. And I grew up in a house that wasn't always challenging culinary-wise, but a very warm, loving house. And I had always wanted to travel the world, and I couldn't afford it. I only had my mom's Volkswagen Golf and my earnings from the Sam Goody store at the mall. So my high school girlfriend and I would go to the unusual and ethnic restaurants in Minneapolis and St. Paul in high school, and that's when I first developed an interest in food, was as a stand-in for travel.
Isn't that something? Because I was thinking that the book is about food and the appeal of food, but it's also a little bit about a class divide. Eva ends up growing up in the home of her aunt and uncle. She declares of them that their tastes are so plebeian, frozen peas and fish sticks and things like that. Is that something that came from your own experience?
I think so. And what's impressive to me is that my dad's taste has evolved commensurate with the rest of the country's. In the last 20 years, as we've seen a new realm of food consciousness, my dad is probably now one of the healthiest eaters I know, and he eats he's as much of a locavore and a farm-to-table guy as anyone I know.
Well, that's, you know, that's what this book does. It sort of tracks that evolution of America's palates through Eva, this precocious young woman who seemed, she and her dad were both sort of at head of this curve. Is she maybe someone you would have wanted to be, growing habanero peppers in her closet?
I did my own version of that growing up. Yeah, I was a little kid with really encompassing obsessions. Like a lot of little kids, I started with dinosaurs, but then I went into U.S. presidents, and I just got to know everything about the U.S. presidents. And then I got into baseball, and Eva does the same thing. I feel like Eva was a lot more focused than I was. She figured out early on what she was good at and what she enjoyed doing and just pursued it. I wish I was like her.
Well, and, but she was something of an outcast, you know.
Yeah. She had a tough time, particularly in middle school, as did I. I was bullied in middle school in much the same way she was. And the sort of friendships that I made at that time, the people who said, "It gets better," made a huge impression on me. And I wanted to help tell that story as well.
Well, and food is the thing that helps her survive the bullying as a child. But how much of this did you have to research? For instance, she grows these chocolate habanero peppers, and one batch is 500,000 Scoville heat units. Her father, Lars, is obsessed. He can't buy a tomato unless he knows whether it's a moon glow with the highest amount of lycopene or a San Marzano, which might be better for paste and sauce. Do you also know these things, or is this what you had to research?
In my life, I'm lucky to know a couple of professional chefs and a few heirloom tomato enthusiasts and a dad who grows hot peppers in his garden. And I just plumb to their knowledge. And I did do a lot of original research. And let me tell you, going back to the Midwest and eating for research, oh, it was pretty fun.
Well, why? What were some of the things that you ate?
Lutefisk. I hadn't had that since I was a kid. I'm not sure if I'll have it again.
Remind people what this gelatinous thing is.
It's a reconstituted whitefish that is the specialty of Scandinavian kitchens during Advent. I went and bought it a few years ago while researching it for this book, and it still tastes like boiled aquarium water. however, you know, the Swedes and the Norwegians who make it in Minnesota tend to douse it in cream sauce, and that sure helps.
Well, but there, you know, there's an interesting setup here. The food starts to represent the class divide, maybe, or the generational divide that we were talking about, the cultural divide. There's a lutefisk, yeah. But then there's also walleye, freshwater fish. Mm. And Eva dines on one in River Falls, Wisconsin, that is to die for. There's also dinner parties with menus like open-face Kobe beef sliders and summer heirloom tomato casserole. There's the dinners that Eva famously begins to make, but then there's also Pat, who makes her dessert bars and is very confused about the change that's happening with food in the area. Tell us more about why you bring Pat into this. You've got Eva soaring as a contemporary chef, but Pat seems so confused about the changes in food.
Oh, that's such a great question. I was born in Pat's world. That's the Minnesota I grew up in, was the world of Lutheran church basement dinners and bars and ambrosia salad, jello salad. And I think that's just great. I love that Minnesota. And I hope the evolving food consciousness in the country and in the upper Midwest doesn't completely erase it. And that chapter, to me, felt like a love letter to that culinary realm of Minnesota. I felt like, oh, man, this is a thriving realm, and it's recipes that, you know, sustained generations through Minnesota. The bar recipes in that chapter are from my great-grandmother's cookbook.
You, in fact, give thanks to your great-grandmother Lois Bly Johnson and her church, the First Lutheran Church of Hunter, North Dakota, and all the contributors to the 1984 edition of the First Lutheran Church Women Cookbook.
Yes. I mostly use the 84 edition. I also have the 1969 edition, but the recipes in that book say things like, cook until done, because they were, quite frankly, written by women that knew how to do it. And so I really enjoyed that realm of American and Midwestern cooking, and I really wanted to honor it. But at the same time, I wanted to recognize, as you put it, the contrast between where that cooking fits in within the current realm of, oh, I guess you could say Epicurean appreciation of food now that's been evolving over the last 20 years or so, that's commensurate with Eva's maturation and rise. I'd like to live in a world where they both exist.
Yeah.
And I think in places like Minnesota, they do, and harmoniously. One of the things I wanted Eva to do was reconcile those two worlds. I also wanted to work in the story of a guy like Jordy Snelling, who, as a deer hunter, he has a more intimate and intense relationship with food than an awful lot of people.
Well, you have Eva bring them all together in the end. We will not give anything away. But it occurs that, boy, Garrison Keillor has nothing on you. I mean, it has that same kind of feel of Prairie Home Companion, only with great recipes. And also with a slightly darker, I mean, you're not afraid of darker off-roads for many of these characters.
Yeah, I decided to make life pretty difficult for some of my characters. And that was hard for me. I love these people. I loved waking up every morning and being in their world and writing them and seeing what they would do. To see them suffer was really, really hard for me. But I felt like, oh, man, they need to grow. They need to evolve. I want to see what they do in the face of challenges. But the best year of my life was spent writing this book and being with these people. And when I finally finished working with the editor, I was so sad to not get to work with these people anymore, to not wake up and be in this world.
Well, J. Ryan Straddle, we have to say that every day reading it was pretty good, too.
Oh, and, thanks.
We smell sequel at the end, we're just saying. Oh. So the book that we're talking about is Kitchens of the Great Midwest, author J. Ryan Straddle. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome, Robin.